Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to episode 60 of The School for Dumb Women. What a milestone. What an age. We can have sex without fear of pregnancy. We've had the menopause. We can crack on with our second marriage and move in with our 35-year-old yoga teacher. What a time to be alive. I'm your host woman, rediscovering carbohydrates after 40 years of self-denial, Hannah Farrell. With me is rewearing everything from her late teens because it'll come back round, Alexandra Haddo.
I'm just so glad I didn't throw those leg warmers and this fake lip ring out, Hannah.
And inventor of old wives' tales, Caroline O'Donoghue.
If you don't wear a mid-length skirt after October, you'll get syphilis, and don't ask me why and don't ask me how.
This week, we're talking about urine, machine learning, and art with a special guest, Gavin Day, and we air someone else's dirty laundry in the Smart Lesson.
I can't wait, mostly because I'm all out of pants. Hannah, I have the strange urge to do this whenever someone goes like this, shh, or whenever I look at a picture of a waterfall, an uncontrollable
interesting.
Urge
to perhaps dump all of your urine.
Yes, that's it. That's the badger.
Yes, this week I wanted to talk about urine, about weeing, about peeing, about pissing, about
golden showers.
Oh. Yes, having a slash,
draining the engine.
There's a lot of draining, isn't there?
Sure.
Isn't there one with a snake?
Yeah, bleeding the radiator?
Draining the snake? Is that one?
Yeah. When I searched wee into Google, which is always the first step, basically, when you're doing this, it came up with wee as in wee bairns. Stop the erasure of wee. We talked about breaking taboos last week, so I thought,
wee erasure. Definitely.
We're going to talk about wee, and it's going to be piss. It's not going to be something small. There is nothing better than a good piss when you need it.
You've never said a truer sentence in your life. A good piss is infinite.
Yeah,
like one
is.
That you really feel like you've drained everything.
Tell me
out.
Your perfect piss.
Okay, I was on a road trip in America and I just had like one of those ridiculously huge drinks that's like 2 liters
or
something.
Yeah.
And we were in traffic. Eventually, we stopped at there was a funeral home on the side of the road and I had to run in and be like, I'm so sorry, respectfully, please could I use your toilet?
Wow.
And I think I weed for 3 minutes.
just one of those ways where like there's like, more coming out still.
Like, is this blood now? Like what's going on?
Yeah. My God.
What's your favourite ever wee?
I did this thing where I was walking home from university and I had my walk was about half an hour. I started walking and about two minutes in I needed a wee and I was so panicked and desperate by the time that I was like 5 minutes away from home that I had to ring my best mate Nat and be like, can you open the door, the front door for me?
Oh my God.
We've all done it.
So I can run in and like Ooh. And like make sure nobody's in the loo. And I was like, don't tell the boys because they'll go in the loo on purpose.
Yeah.
I had a fabulous wee one time. I just remembered it now. Where it was back in my single days. I'd gotten off with this guy outside a pub after closing time.
Sure.
And while this was happening, the romance and the sexual tension was mounting, but I realised I needed a piss bad and nowhere was open at this point. We're talking quarter to three in the morning.
No.
I was too insecure at the time. I was too young. I couldn't just go excuse myself to go piss in an alley.
Yeah.
Because he'd be like, you're pissing in an alley. You are no longer the girl of my dreams.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I said to him, I think I left my purse inside. Would you please go ask the doorman or whatever? Like, go basically go knock on the door because they won't talk to me. I'm just a girl. Essentially,
what?
I conned this guy into trying to go back into the pub while I ran down an alley and went for a piss and then I came back.
When did you last wet yourself?
My 23rd birthday. The night of.
What did you do? Just get so pissed that you
pissed yourself? I just got that's exactly it. I just was walking home from the bus stop with my legs together and I couldn't make it and I pissed myself. That's all there is to it.
What do you guys think is the world record for the longest wee? How long was the longest wee?
6 minutes.
I was about to say 6 minutes as well. Weird.
It's 8 minutes and 28 seconds.
Wow. Was it a woman?
I don't know whether it was a woman or a man, actually. I can't find any information on it. And also, I've just seen another person claiming that the world's longest wee was 36 minutes. So
that cannot be true.
Yeah, maybe just ignore all the facts.
You'd be dead.
Wee is 95% water. I don't know, that seems higher. That's higher than I thought it would be.
Yeah.
What's the rest of it?
2.5% urea.
Mm-hmm. Heard of it.
2.5% like salt, hormones, nutrients, creatine, which is a byproduct of like your liver breaking down all the water and stuff.
Why is it good for you? People say that drinking your own piss is one of the best things you can do.
It's not.
Oh,
it's really not.
Doesn't come as a surprise.
No, apparently it is a thing that's been around for ages. Like lots of different cultures in history have said, yeah, this is good for you, this will cure you of whatever. Mm. It's not. You're just putting all the things that your body does not want back into your body
exactly
for them to filter out again. Did you see that video of a woman who says that drinking her dog's piss cured her acne?
No.
Oh, it was a video that was going around like Facebook and stuff a few months ago, and she like literally puts a plastic cup under her dog while it's weeing like against a tree and then just drinks it straight.
Oh!
And there's obviously we don't know whether it was real or not. It could have been faked. It's
the
just
point
horrible.
Is she had to do that without knowing that it was going to cure her acne.
Well, she said it did cure her acne, but it's also like, well, acne can clear up for any number of reasons. Maybe you were less stressed because you thought you had a cure. And then your lack of stress made your acne.
In fairness, I've never seen a dog with acne, so it could be true.
That's true.
That's true.
What would Sylvie's pee have to do to you to make you drink it?
Oh, I think cure cystitis, actually, ironically.
Oh, yeah. Really?
Yeah, because it is my most persistent medical trauma.
Oh, God, I fucking hate it.
Yeah.
Would you drink it warm?
No.
Would that be better?
I think it would be better to put it in the fridge for a few hours.
Oh, yeah. It'd kind of be virtually tasteless, wouldn't it?
You could kind of pretend it was juice. One thing I also wanted to look up, if you are alone in a desert and you're lost, can you survive drinking your own piss?
Yes, the big Bear Grylls argument.
Yes,
exactly. And I met someone that did survive drinking their own piss.
Really?
They were in the papers and everything. Yeah, it's a very interesting story.
The one in the Australian outback?
Yes, I met him.
I feel like you've told us about him, maybe.
And he drank his own piss and his contact lens solution.
Oh, lovely. But it sounds like you can drink your own piss if you like really have to.
Yeah.
But after like more than a couple of days, it will start to like be really bad for you because all of the like urea and stuff in the wee that your body wants to get rid of will just become more and more concentrated because there's more of it in it.
Yeah.
And also, although you're replacing the water that's gone out, there's water that comes out of your body that doesn't come out in your piss. So like in sweat and like in your breathing and stuff like that. So like you're just kind of concentrating down all of these things and your kidneys will probably collapse. But also apparently if you've had an injury, so like, I don't know, say you broke your arm and then you got stuck in the desert, or you broke your arm and that's why you got stuck in the desert.
Yeah.
Apparently then you shouldn't drink your pee because there will be more byproducts in your piss because your body is trying to heal itself. Isn't that interesting? So if you're like pretty much healthy, you could drink your piss a little bit, maybe, if you really want to, but you might as well just not.
Right. Because it's like your body's ill. It's not, but it's like not on a balance.
Yeah, exactly. There's a website called Primal Survivor, which is one of those like typical American kind of like, so when Russia bombs us all,
this
Americans is how we're
really
going to survive in our basements. And they talk about some examples of people who have drunk their own wee to survive. Apparently there was a Chinese man who was trapped under earthquake rubble for 6 days and survived by drinking his urine. Mm. There's the guy in that film that amputated his own arm.
Oh, yeah.
James Franco.
Yes. He drank his own urine to survive. And in Rome, nuns stuck in an elevator survived by praying and drinking urine.
That sentence also works if you take out praying.
Yeah. there was an amazing article in Washington Post that told me more, which said the two nuns from Ireland and New Zealand were by themselves in a 4-story residence for nuns near the Vatican. And they got stuck in the elevator. There was a power failure. And the nuns were 58 and 68 years old. And they left their phones in their rooms, like, oh, obviously.
Why didn't they turn it into wine?
And they couldn't call for help. The only item they had with them were their rosary beads. But then that makes me think, how do they gather the piss to drink it?
Ew.
Oh, are they going straight from the source?
I don't know.
Just piss into their robes and then wring it into their mouth.
You came up with that image pretty quickly. Hannah, I appreciate what you're trying to do here. You're focusing on the piss drinking to sex up piss for us.
Yes.
But you're not answering the question that I really want you to answer, which is, why is it when you go on your first piss on a night out, you have to piss loads?
Oh,
why
breaking is breaking the seal?
Breaking the seal.
I didn't research that.
Idiot.
Yeah, I'm thinking that too.
I feel like I'm a real victim of breaking the seal. Like,
maybe the alcohol like kind of reduces your ability to hold the piss in, because basically you've got the bladder where all the piss is stored,
yeah.
And then you've got two sphincters. You've got the internal sphincter, which goes from your bladder into the urethra, which is like the pipe that the piss comes through,
yeah.
And then you've got the external sphincter, which is where you release the piss from.
Oh. And then your butt sphincter as well.
And then you have
the sphincter, yeah. Just like a word for release valve?
Yeah. Wow. Sphincter is just like any valve in the body, I think.
It's not a butt specific word.
No.
Oh, you knew.
I knew it wasn't butt specific, okay. But I know it's yeah.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say I knew about the double sphincters.
So maybe it is just that when you've drunk, you're kind of like, oh, like the signals from your bladder are getting confused or something. And you're like, oh, no, I need to wee again.
And they probably get weaker as well. Like when you get pissed, everything just gets loose, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know.
Including your sexual morals.
There was a great video on YouTube. It's called The Science Show. And it was a guy talking about pissing. And he said, holding your pee is only bad for you if you do it frequently for a really long time. And there's receptors on your bladder wall that measure how full your bladder is. And that if you've been drinking, sometimes your brain won't recognize the messages from your bladder or whatever. I mean, this is super, super, super rare, but it can cause your bladder to burst.
Ooh.
Because normally you just, if your bladder's full and like you're trying to hold it in, you just wet yourself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like your sphincters would just be like, that's enough.
Do you guys ever do this thing? Where, say if you really, really need to piss and you're on your way to the toilet, but you know that like it's another two flights of stairs and you're like, even though you're on the brink of pissing yourself, it's going to be another minute. Do you ever do that thing where you like try and trick your brain and you're like, I don't need to pee.
Yeah.
I have a mild urge to pee.
Yeah.
And sometimes it kind of works.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also I feel like sometimes when I feel like I really need to pee, it will go back in.
Yeah.
Yes, it does.
And I don't think it physically does go back in.
And you kind of almost forget that you needed to pee in the first
place. Yeah, that is really weird.
Yeah.
I also do think moving does help. Like if I only really need to pee someone in the
around,
bathroom.
Dancing in the queue.
And like walking up and down, that sort of helps.
Totally.
Yeah, completely. Yeah. I have no idea why that is. I didn't research that either.
And sometimes I do that thing where it's like, I need to pee, but there's no toilet, so I just eat things because I think that it would like soak
back
it up.
Yeah, I've
done that.
That doesn't work. That work?
But I like to eat.
Probably not.
So
yeah.
I also found out about someone called Tycho Brahe, whose bladder allegedly burst and killed him. Yeah. He was an astronomer in the 1600s. He attended a banquet in Prague and didn't want to leave the banquet to relieve himself because it would have been a breach of etiquette. This is from Wikipedia.
Wow.
There was also a breach of etiquette, dying at the table.
Yeah. Mm. So after he went home, he was no longer able to wee. Except in very small quantities and with excruciating pain.
How long was this fucking banquet?
Yeah, and then he was like in delirium for like 11 days or something and then died. So he might have died from uremia, which is like urea in the blood, which comes from kidney failure.
Oh, great.
Yeah, or he died from mercury poisoning, it says.
Oh, so,
okay, which we did in an early episode.
Or the other. So yeah, I might actually go for a wee right now. That's not even a joke.
Yeah, great. I actually need some water, so the cycle of piss can continue.
The circle of life.
The cycle of piss.
Guys, imagine there's no heaven.
Done.
It's easy if you try.
I don't have to try because it's a statistical probability that there's no heaven.
Caroline, I don't know why you're a novelist. You have absolutely no imagination.
Well, good thing this week's Wim New Code is about inventing imagination, specifically for me.
That is right. Today's Wim New Code mixer is on dueling neural networks.
Can I sing now or what?
Yeah, you can sing.
Imagine there's no heaven. The end.
At the Women of Code Mixer, we investigate the technology trends we overhear men talking about while we're waiting to get served at Carphone Warehouse. This week, we're talking about dueling neural networks. I'm assuming you guys don't know what it is.
I have no idea. Also, I like that you say dueling and not dueling.
Well, I'm foreign. So now you've done that thing where you've said it, and now I keep looking at it being like, how do I say that?
Sorry.
Now, dueling neural networks might sound like two nerds having a fight in the bit of green outside Morrison's, but actually it refers to the latest development in artificial intelligence.
Oh.
Yeah, so... bit of a weird one, but apparently it's going to be the big thing in the tech over the next year, according to TechCrunch and Wired, both of which I read for at least a minute today.
Great.
Oh, well done. You'll be on The Economist next.
I think I might. So dueling neural networks describes a breakthrough in AI that allows it basically to create images of things it's never seen before.
Oh, creepy.
Very creepy, right? So before, everything that robots tell us and everything that know is based on things that we feed it.
No,
do you know what I mean?
This is
we
bad.
Give it information, it parrots the information back to us in some way or another.
Right.
But this, essentially dueling neural networks allows for computers to learn off one another. So you set up these two AIs and one of them will create images based on things it pulls together online or whatever. Just makes up things from scratch, which is a weird concept to think about a computer doing.
It can have sexual fantasies.
It can have fantasies. It can imagine things, essentially. Then it plays that to its buddy AI, and then that tries to figure out what's wrong about the image that makes it not real. And they essentially learn off each other. They just sort of like bat that idea back and forth until they create something that is perfect.
Right.
And what kind of thing is that going to be?
Well, they say that it's it'll be good for fraud recognition technology. But it just seems like one of those weird kind of Turing test things where, at what point, if a computer has imagination, that means it can make art, right? It can like write a poem or something. Not because it's like found poems online and glue them together, because it's actually thought of it. So at what point does it become a person?
I was about to say, surely that means it's not a robot.
Yeah.
Does it have dreams, though?
I don't know. I mean, what my question is for you two. What level of imagination would a computer have to show you for you to stop treating it as a slave? Because that's what we do with our computers. We just make them order discount tights and show us porn.
I think it would have to show emotion.
Really?
Yeah.
But how would it show that to you?
I don't know. It's a computer. It can invent itself a face.
So, okay. So, let's say you're editing a podcast.
As is my want.
As is your want. Yes. You're up late, you're editing a podcast, and you're doing that thing where like your computer's being sort of slow and you're like, for fuck's sake, edit the audio. Me revealing, I have no idea what you do. The screen goes black and the green writing comes up and it's like, Hannah, when you speak that way, it hurts my feelings.
Then I'd be like, oh my God.
Would that
I'm
be
so
enough?
Sorry.
Or would, and then it goes back to your normal screen. And then everything resumed. But would you like be like, oh, that was a prank or that was a thing?
I
or
would
you...
freak out.
I definitely think it was a prank, yeah.
Yeah. So that's what I'm saying. What level would it have to do for you to actually take it seriously? Or would we have to wait until we're all enslaved?
I think, I'd have to wait until they all started to unionize. And then I'd be like, oh, maybe this is a thing.
Yeah. But then it's like, what's weird about that is like, if you think about when you read about like atrocities of human nature and like all the terrible things people have done, and it's basically always the same, which is that like, oh, we treated X group of people or X animal or X whatever really badly until they all unionized and rose up against us.
Yeah.
Or we fought. So are we as bad as those?
Well, I don't treat my computer badly, I don't think. Do I? I would probably overwork it.
I mean, it's your slave.
Yeah. Oh, that's true. I don't take it out much.
No, you
just
don't.
Now think that I love
never mine. Taken it to a nice restaurant.
How often do you even install updates? How often do you say later and then later never
every
comes?
Every time.
It's in so much pain. It would take 2 minutes of your time.
Oh God, I'm sorry.
Just close down a couple of applications and restart a few minutes later.
Your donation could help take 10 computers out of poverty.
Let's take the ball on to Disneyland.
The more I talk to you lads, the more I think that maybe the computers deserve to rise up against us.
Yeah.
Because you have no empathy for our computer friends. I'm saying this loudly with my laptop open.
Yeah, fine. So Hannah, you've gone slightly green and pale. You look very scared and weak and maybe malnourished. What's going on?
Yeah, no, I've not been eating lately, Alex, because a few weeks ago I spent my life savings on 3 centimetres of shredded Banksy. And honestly, I still can't tell whether it's an investment or not, maybe because of my low blood sugar.
It's okay. Come on.
But luckily, I've invited Gavin Day here.
Hello all.
That name is familiar to me.
Gavin Day.
Somehow.
Good evening.
Is he a famous artist?
Resident art expert for this evening only, I think. Yeah. I'm a graphic designer, that's okay.
So Gavin Day does the logos for School for Dumb Women, the excellent logo. And you're here to tell us kind of why art is so damn expensive. Like, it doesn't make sense, really, that art's so expensive.
No, so it's like, Picasso used to pay for dinners with sketches he did, which is like a really baller move, but also kind of a like horrible thing for a guy to do. Like, imagine like saying, no, we need your money. Because you did a sketch on
yeah,
a napkin
like,
of like...
I've got to pay my rent.
So anyway, art never used to cost that much money. And it's a weird day today, actually, guys, because today is the 35th anniversary of an auction that changed why art now costs so much money. It was called the Skull Auction, not with a K, with a C, but it is Halloween, so the Skull Auction.
Of course.
This was a guy called Robert Skull, who owned...
He sounds fit.
He wasn't fit. His wife was pretty hot. In fact, Warhol did a couple of paintings of her. Even the director of the Metropolitan Museum of Art was like, I want to get a painting of her. She's a pretty good-looking chick. I made no bones about it.
Oh, it's New York. It's the 60s. Everyone's awful.
Yeah, I'm enjoying the accents a lot.
Yeah. So his auction was the first time anyone had ever sold off their entire collection as like a mass hoard and treated it like essentially as a commodity.
Okay.
And
this guy, like, he'd curated it.
Yeah, like what Saatchi is now or was in the early 90s, he was like way, way before that.
Right.
So tell me what happened at this art auction. How were people responding to it? What went on?
So it was the first time that the public had really got involved in an art auction, and he made sure that happened. He was a seriously shrewd guy, advertised it loads. Yeah, he sort of just loved himself a bit. There's a hilarious archive clip of him sitting in the front room of his house talking about how, you know, art is acquisition is involvement, and I just do it to help the little guy, and it's not about me. And the cameraman must have known what he was doing. Like, he slowly pans out, and over his fireplace is an enormous picture of his own face. It's so big. It's like a Manhattan loft, and it goes from floor to ceiling. It's like, if you were in that room, it is the most imposing picture of someone.
That's
like,
amazing.
Oh, that's just me. That's what I do. Yeah, so anyway, he puts on the show. The public love it. The prices of his art that he bought for really not very much is astronomical. There's a painting called Double White Map by Jasper Johns that ends up selling for, it's a 2,500% markup from what he paid for it. And the artist didn't get any kickback. And they hated him.
Artists normally get a little percentage of the value when it sells?
It had never been a problem up until that point, so they never bothered.
Yeah.
So he changed all that. So they actually lobbied Washington after this, some American artists, and they nearly got it passed, and then it got kicked back. So since that show, no artist has ever made any money off the back of that. But it changed the politics of it after that show. So Robert Rauschenberg, who's quite famous, you might have heard of him, he's like a pop artist, came up with Warhol. He's kind of on par with them. He's like the critics' version of Warhol. The public know who Warhol is, but Rauschenberg's like, you know, the fuckboy of the critics. Everyone
knows him.
He picketed the show and got a bunch of artists to picket the show with him. And they had, like, literally outside the show marching. They had really rubbish chants. It was like, they buy with their millions, they buy with their millions. It was like the worst chant.
They kind of overthought it.
Yeah.
Because they're all artists. Like, they're not like the working man. They're just like, it's too intellectual, this chant.
Yeah. Rauschenberg was pissed. He had his painting sold for like he sold his painting to this guy for like $1,000. And Robert Skull would always be like, three sales are nothing. Like, that sort of, you know, he wouldn't buy your paintings unless you sold him three for a cut rate. And then he sold Rauschenberg paintings for like 40 grand, 60 grand, 80 grand. This Jasper Johns painting sold for 250K and he bought it for 10 grand. Jasper Johns was like,
oh my God.
You'd be pissed, wouldn't you? You'd be so pissed.
So what's the fallout?
So the fallout is that this happens in 1973. After that, loads of things, that was a result of loads of things. Artists were like, okay, we need to get our cut now. So they started charging higher prices at the start.
Mm.
Other people started looking at the show like, oh my God, you can make a ton of money with art. So the conversation turned from, what does this painting mean, to how much does this painting cost?
Right.
And then it became a whole thing. And this is before the 80s. Then the 80s happened. The 80s! You know, it's like not a decade known for its restraint. And then prices just went insane.
Right.
So people would buy a Picasso. And at that point, art just went from being something that's about aesthetics to just an investment. And, like, you know, the CEO of, like, Citibank would buy a Picasso for 5 million. Mm. This actually happened. He bought a Picasso for 6 million in 1981, sat on it for 8 years, and sold it for 48 million in 1989.
Right.
So at that point, it just becomes like the start of the story, and that's the discussion about art we have now, which is the start of the story, the middle of the story, and the end of the story is how much does it cost? That's how people know about art. Mm. And that's why you get like people like The Sun in the early 90s being like, it's an unmade bed. I'm not paying £5 million for an unmade bed. Mm, it's a shark in a tank. Why am I paying? And, you know, and that's why critics who have lived long enough to see this before the prices went crazy are just up in arms. Like, the art market and the prices in the art market are the big shock factor of the last 50 years.
It's difficult as well, isn't it? Because if you're starting out as an artist and you're creating something which is, you know, you think is really good or whatever, you still can't charge, you know, 50 grand for your painting until you're like a bit famous. And then there's still someone who's going to profit off of you selling something for £200.
It's like trend forecasting. It's, you know what I mean? So it becomes much more about like guessing the next thing rather than art, which is what it's supposed to be about, quote unquote, which is judging what you are versus the world and how to make something out of that. And also art, again, big conversation, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, what we're talking about here are art objects. Like, no one's buying performance art. You can't buy it. There's, like, no performance artists make money, really. Marina Abramovich, but that's off her fame as opposed to her actual works. You can't really buy someone staring at you.
What intrigues me is, who decides if the person is cool and worth millions?
Yeah.
How do you create that buzz of, like, this cow in formaldehyde is worth trillions of pounds?
Well, it has to have like a patina, you know, not the actual physical thing. Like, it has to have a kind of an aura or a glow around it as a thing.
Je ne sais quoi.
Like, if you were to, like, John Berger did an amazing thing on this. He's like, if you were to find out this is just a champagne flute, I guess, from IKEA.
Probably, yeah.
If you were to find out that's like the last champagne flute that Diana held before she died, suddenly that takes on a whole new thing.
And it was.
And it takes on that kind of, that aura, that sense of like, am I allowed to touch it? Should I touch it? And that's what the money attempts to do.
Yeah.
It makes you feel like you can't judge it. Suddenly it's so expensive. Who the hell are you? Who are you, Mr. 24 grand a year, to say this thing is not worth something? It's like, strikes you blind.
Yeah.
Robert Hughes, Australian art critic, was always like, these prices, they have a cultural function. Their function is to strike you blind. And it was always like, you'd always talk about the price of art just completely taken out of the realm of reality, which is what it's supposed to be for.
Yeah.
But what's interesting about that is there's almost like a reciprocal thing. So it's like the money attaches meaning to the art, but the person spending the money then gets the glow of the art attached to them.
Yeah.
They're a person who understands and gets art.
Hmm.
So do you think that's why maybe that the prices exploded in the 80s, because it's this age of new money and people making a lot of money very quickly, and they're like almost trying to like buy their way into a class by liking art.
Plus, and it's not all bad. Like, the idea that art should be, the director of the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York in the 60s was all about like breaking down barriers, and why should going into an art gallery be any more aristocratic than going into a movie theatre? It's all about just making it available to you. It shouldn't be treated like an academic subject.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting you said that, because I went to an exhibition at the Barbican not too long ago, and it was a photography exhibition, and there were some really nice photos, and photos like quite accessible, right? You just kind of look at them and you're like, oh, that's real life, but it looks really nice.
Yeah. That's such a brilliant... Yeah.
But the captions that they've put underneath these photos were just absolutely unreadable.
Yeah.
You just could not understand what they were trying to say, because they were referencing different artists and they were referencing different styles. And it just felt like, this isn't for me.
Yeah. And that's what comes back to the, this is all about the money thing, because you feel like you can't talk about it. Because it's, I mean, what's that painting that went for of Jesus, like £350 million? For what? I know it's a Leonardo painting, but like, for what?
Yeah.
Somebody goes to see the Mona Lisa and you realise like you could put that in a tote bag and walk out, because it's not very big. You're like, I queued up for this.
You know when you were talking about
the size of an iPad.
Yeah.
The Mona Lisa actually is a funny one, because that, you know, you could argue that started the whole thing before. The reason Skull got into collecting it is because the Mona Lisa visited New York in 1963, and it was this massive publicity thing, and that was the first ever like blockbuster show in America, and then that began a whole like wave. They called it like a cultural extension of the arms race, because the Kennedys wanted it to be seen like, oh, this is where it's happening.
Yeah.
This is where the culture is happening. Not in Russia, nowhere, not in Europe, the US. This is where it's going down. And then that started a whole public interest in art, when pop art came in and post-war aspiration, and everyone was involved in the media and like democratizing of art. Skull took that and fucked us in 73.
Well, wow. He just did the American thing, didn't he?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Sold it all.
He had
like,
the power. He had money. Any problems? Yeah, yeah, he did. Yeah, exactly.
We mentioned Banksy in the introduction. Like, what do you think of it? Obviously, I'm sure everyone has heard.
Yeah.
But recently, a painting of his was sold at Sotheby's. Or was it even a painting? Like a drawing, a print? I'm not sure what it was.
I think he actually did that spray. Because you can make prints of stuff, but I think he actually did the spray paint.
It was actually, okay, yeah. And then there was a shredder in the bottom of the frame. And as soon as it was sold, as soon as the hammer went down, the painting fell through the shredder and actually got jammed halfway. Apparently it was meant to shred the whole thing.
Oh, did it?
Yeah,
I didn't
apparently.
Know that.
But what do you make of that?
I don't buy that it was meant to go all the way through. Like, because I think it was delayed. Because it stays as an intact object. If it's half done... First of all, as if Sotheby's didn't know. You know what I mean? Like, oh, here's a frame.
Yeah.
I've never used a period frame before, but I'm going to use it. And it's very heavy, but don't look inside or scan
it.
Oh. You know what I mean? And they could get in a lot of trouble, actually, because of that. Because they could be seen as fixing the prices, because it was an event and a stunt. And people now want to just talk about the meme. Oh, that's the shredded thing. Like, imagine having a non-shredded Banksy that looks like that. You're like, oh, I got done there.
Yeah.
I should have bought it. Should have waited 2 months.
Yeah.
So you don't think that it's like a worthwhile commentary on art dealership at all? Do you think it's totally cynical?
Yes, when it comes to him now, like, he's lost. You could say he's doing this as like a long-term performance art piece or whatnot, and business is the best art and blah blah blah. But like, if you're gonna, I mean, Will Gompertz of the BBC said this was the biggest moment in art since Duchamp's urinal, like, which happened like 100 years ago. I read that. I mean, you saw me reading it. I was like, close the laptop. Like,
yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And like, it's, you know, it is a stunt, and I get that, but I wouldn't say it's the biggest moment in art.
Yeah. I don't know. He's kind of playing off that kind of like bad boy, like, oh, I don't play by the rules. I'm going to shred my own thing, but also the price is going to triple. I'm going to profit off that. You know what I mean?
I'm Banksy, like, you know, I'm a rascal.
It is. It's
I'll like, rascal you out of your money.
It is. It's like the guy walking around, the, you know, 55-year-old guy walking around with his Rage Against the Machine hoodie on. It's like, mate, come on.
Yeah.
Come on. And also the painting itself, like, no one's talking about the fact. It's just a girl with a balloon. Like,
yeah, it's like, yeah. It's the one that, like, you'll find in Camden Market on T-shirts.
Yeah.
I did have that T-shirt, wow. Yeah, like 10 years ago.
But then again, like, I don't really like it as a piece of graffiti, but now I'm forced to have, like, a strong opinion about it because, it's like, you know what I mean? It makes you insane. I'd see that on a street corner. I'd be like, oh, someone did that, fine. But now I have to be like, you hear all this like noise and you have to sort of go mindfulness on everyone and be like, I will shut it out and just go to a gallery.
Yeah.
And like, you have to just, like, it's a Herculean effort to make up your own mind, and these prices just come there to just like boot you out and say you don't matter, it's just the market thing. But now you could argue this is just that the last cries of an irrelevant art form just trying to get what it can before it goes out, and then everyone's just going to say fuck this.
Do you think that's what's going to happen then? What do you think is the future of the art world?
Well, how
huge
the
question.
Hell, so like
in
so,
2 minutes.
So taking like that painting that's been sold, the new Leonardo that was found, that got sold for £350 million. It's been loaned to the Abu Dhabi Louvre. They've made a Louvre in Abu Dhabi now. No one knows who bought it. It's supposed to be, I think it's an Arab buyer, secret Arab buyer. It's like, how is that going to make a profit? Everyone's like, how? What? It's not even a good painting. Surely this is like a really long, do you call it? Tulip mania or whatever. It's just another one of them.
Tulip mania?
Yeah, it's like inflated market prices way beyond the value of the thing.
Oh, wow.
And everyone just agrees that this thing is worth a lot of money until everyone wakes up one day and goes, what the fuck are we doing?
It's like the king has no clothes.
Yeah. We have all the tulips, the king has no clothes.
Yeah.
So, Gavin, I'll see you at home. This has been a wonderful talk on the nature of art and commerce.
Gavin, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Please use his real name, Gavin Day.
Gavin Day.
Gavin Day. Where can people find out more about you on your Twitter account that you never use?
You can find me on my very limited edition Twitter account at _GavinDay.
Ah. Clean. I like it.
Mm.
Like me.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Well, what an adventure! To round off the podcast each week, we have a smart lesson in which we aim to wave a magic wand and turn ourselves into smart women. And a large part of being a smart woman, of course, is being emotionally intelligent, which is our excuse for dragging other people's personal business through the mud in our guidance counsellor smart lesson. So, what is this week's problem, Alex?
This week's problem is about being in a state of undress. It's a woman who has a partner, and he has two teenage daughters, 13 and 17. So she says, he and his daughters tend to be half-dressed in their home, like he walks around in a short but shirtless frequently. His 13-year-old seems to be in her underwear most of the day when she's at home. His 16-year-old seems to be dressed a bit more, but is also frequently wearing only a bra on top. One time about 3 months ago, I fell asleep there for a few hours, and when I woke up, they were in the living room lying on the couch bed. They were under a blanket, and he was in the middle, over the blanket, shirtless, sort of petting their heads around their shoulders watching TV. Is it me, or are they somehow unusual, or even weird? I understand why she might feel a little bit weird, but I think every family has their own nudity boundaries.
Yeah.
And, like, unless, you know, he's doing something weird, then it's not weird. You know what I mean?
I guess at the beginning I was like, oh, shirtless dad in underwear walking around the house. Fine. I can completely imagine that or whatever. I don't know why. And maybe it's completely the way we're socialised. But like then the idea of having like teenage girls in their bra and pants just wandering around seems really strange.
Yeah, the dad thing didn't really bother me.
But then again, like, why is it strange?
Yeah, how bad is that? That we're just like, oh, well, the guy's okay, but the girls, like, we're meant to be feminists, for God's sake.
It really exposes our own prejudice, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But to be fair, I think it's their age. I don't think it's that they're girls. I think if there was an equivalent with teenage boys, we'd probably feel the same.
I don't know, because I grew up with brothers, and I remember not really feeling weird about them being in box. But they would, like, walk around the house naked or anything. But if I saw them in their shorts, I wouldn't really react. But I'd never walk around them with my bra and pants on.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
But then bikinis are fine, which is
weird. So weird. They should change the fabric and everyone's fine.
Make it a jazzy print.
Yeah.
So, it's so strange.
Yeah.
And it's that weird way of how we treat, like, women's bodies of, like, like a man's body is neutral, but a woman's body is, like, flirty and sexy, no matter what state, even if you're just, like, sitting around watching TV with your dad.
Yeah.
It's mad.
Yeah, because if it was, like, a 60-year-old who's going around naked, you'd be like, oh, they're only six, like, cool, whatever.
Yeah.
But then as soon as they're, what are they in here, 13 and 16, you're kind of like, oh, well.
So, yeah, they have, like, their sexual organs are maturing.
Changes are happening to your body.
There's fur where there was no fur before.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. It's like you're starting to be aware of sex. That's why we're weirded out by it.
But then also think of, like, imagine, remember all the hang-ups you had about your body when you were that age. And I imagine, I'm willing to guess, these girls don't really have those. Because if they did, they wouldn't be so sort of free and happy in themselves around the house.
Yeah, maybe they're sort of like, maybe obviously not like entirely nudist, but maybe they're just like semi-nudists, and that's kind of cool.
Clearly the dad has raised them with a pretty good sense of self.
Yeah.
You know, but then again, this is all easy to say intellectually, but if it came down to the wire and my boyfriend and his teenage daughters were hanging around the house naked, would I feel freaked out?
Ah, but it's not naked. He's not fully naked. I don't think you'd be freaked out.
But
that would freak me out.
Yeah.
But I think you'd sort of have to be like, yeah, good for that. Because you don't want to be the one that's like, cover yourself up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You are shameful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you'd just have to try and override your own prejudices with your intellect and be like,
yeah,
this is fine. This is not a weird thing.
And her the tone of her letter is very much like, she doesn't seem to think that these girls don't understand boundaries or they're, you know what I mean?
Yeah, there's a really interesting bit, actually, which we didn't read out, that says she talks about her own children. And she says, last time my son walked into his sister changing, she pretty much yelled at him to get out. And she was shirtless with a bra on, not even half naked. And that's kind of like, oh, yeah, well, like, maybe that's bad.
Yeah. Like, obviously, you don't want your dad to see you naked, obviously. Yeah. But it should just be like, dad, get out.
Yeah.
You know, not like, ah, which is everybody's response, you know.
Like, some people just have different boundaries. I think especially if you've got a family where it's all one gender, people tend to be really chill.
Yeah, I can picture that, yeah.
What I find quite, like, sad and depressing, because I've got a couple of friends who I can be naked around, and I think it's very actually nice.
Oh, yeah.
Because you see your friend for, like, oh, like, you think she's way thinner than you, or way prettier than you, or way something than you.
Yeah.
And then you actually see her body, and you're like, oh, you're just like a animal like I am an animal, you know?
Yeah.
But then, like, I think more and more in male groups of friends, you get the kind of naked hangout boys, right?
Yeah.
There's always those groups of uni lads who, like, have been friends for years and years, and they're always naked together.
Yes.
And I always get a bit jealous that there isn't more of that in girl groups.
Yeah, it's like a part of the bro culture. Should we do this podcast naked next week?
Yeah.
We should do a naked podcast! Yeah.
Oh, I'm always naked with my best friend.
Okay.
Lads, shall we, next week's podcast, we'll strip off.
Yeah, done. Ha!
Well, that's it for another week of learning, unlearning, and mixing fact with fiction. But hey, at least you can take someone out on a date to an art fair and sound like you might know what a Pikachu looks like. Picasso. If you liked this podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe to it. Tweet about it, blog it, Instagram about it. Hell, take a photo of it on a disposable camera and get it developed at Boots just to tell someone.
And then get it shredded.
Yes.
That sounds amazing.
Thanks to Harry Harris for doing our jingles, Gavin Day, who was on the show, for coming in and for doing our logo.
He's real!
And Soho Radio Studios for the recording space. We'll be back next week, so until then, goodbye!
Bye!
I've seen Gavin's penis. That's great. We'll put, like, a little towel under our badges, though, because it gets really warm in here.
Yeah,
and
play.
They'd probably send us a bill. For cleaning.
Cleaning.
Yeah.
One of them's burned through the chair.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.